Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. Arts and entertainment as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. In the summer of last year, we heard from author John Chulian about his book, The Great American Sports Page, A Century of Classic Columns. Tonight, we'll hear another side of John, the Hollywood writer side, involving L.A. Law, Miami Vice, Wise Guy, Midnight Caller. He even created the character of Xena, Warrior Princess. First, though, also in the summer of last year, another rather special 50th anniversary. Emmanuel Rogers has more.
As a great treat, joining us today is Rod Pyle, author of First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. Rod will guide us through the amazing effort made by so many innovative people who made it possible for mankind to walk on the surface of the moon. Thank you for joining us today, Rod.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Oh, you are welcome. This, as I said, it is a real treat. So with the time that we have, I want to try to get as much information to our audience as we can. So before we begin to talk about that monumental task of the Apollo missions, will you share with our audience a bit about who you are in the space and scientific community?
So I grew up during the space race, which was an incredible time to be alive. Yes. And was able to see these missions firsthand. I was old enough to understand what was going on. And when other kids were excited about football and basketball stars, I was an astronaut fanatic. So you can probably tell how many friends I had in elementary school. But my parents had the foresight to let me stay home and watch these, at least as much as the networks would cover them at that time. We only had three networks.
Yes.
I was hooked. So I spent a lot of time in college fiddling around with sciences and so forth, but ultimately decided that I was going to be happier in communications. So I ended up going to film school, and then later going and finishing graduate work at Stanford, and moved on from there to start working in media, and ultimately ended up in documentaries, which was a great deal of fun. But the problem there is you're trying to tell the entire Apollo program in 44 minutes if you're working in cable television, and it's really kind of like the TV guide or the Twitter version of that story. It's just too compact.
Yes.
So I finally decided in the early 2000s I wanted to write books, and I've been doing it ever since. And other than radio, I'll say for your sake, it's the most wonderful way to make a living that I can imagine. It's not a great living, but it's the most fun that you can have, I think, working anywhere. So it's just been a thrill.
Yeah, you know, it's about the same here, because there's so much in your book, First on the Moon, that I wish we had so much more time, because we cannot cover all of the wonderful things, pictures and all, that are in here. We'll do the best we can. Before July 20th, 1969, a decision had been made to seek to land men on the moon. Who made this decision and why?
This is President John Kennedy. Came into office in 1960. By 1961, had seen the Soviet Union pulling way ahead of us in terms of space flight. They orbited the first satellite. They orbited the first man around the Earth. And the U.S. looked like it was standing still. You know, we were having our rockets blowing up on the pads before we got our first satellite up. And when the Soviets set that first man, Yuri Gagarin, into orbit, we were still sending chimps up in our space capsules for test flights. We were being very cautious. This was the German way. It was basically Germans from World War II who had developed the early rocketry programs that were running that part of NASA at the time, the rocketry side.
Right.
So Kennedy said, you know, hey, science advisors, I need something that you can tell me that we can do before the Russians can, because they're making us look bad. And a lot of these non-aligned nations are looking at the U.S. saying, what's the deal? We thought you guys were the big kids on the block. So his science advisors came back and said, the only thing we're certain we can do first is land a person on the moon. Orbiting the moon, they might be able to do. They got bigger rockets, certainly a space station they can do faster than we can. So let's do a moon landing. So that was Kennedy's challenge. It was geopolitically motivated way more than it was about science or engineering. And then shortly thereafter, he's assassinated, and Lyndon Johnson inherits the presidency and the Apollo program, the moon landing program. And now it's in this weird kind of never-never land of being supported by Johnson, even though he's now moving into the Vietnam War. And there's a lot of people on both sides of the aisle looking to put a bullet in the Apollo program because they're kind of tired of all those expenditures. But, you know, it's Kennedy's program. You don't want to shut that down. You're going to be very unpopular. So while popular support kind of went up and down in the 60s at about the same level it is now, it wasn't terribly high, we did manage to soldier on, and then once the landing started occurring, it gained a lot of popularity and continued on through Apollo 13. After that, again, it began to decline a bit, and to today we're watching, again, kind of a mixed bag of public support and Congress being a little waffly on are they going to support this new moon landing. The good news is we've got people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos who are billionaires and who said, you know, I was inspired by Apollo. I want to build rockets, and if NASA's not going to do it, I'll do it myself. So this is kind of a new space age we're looking at now.
Well, now I'm curious because I hear blame about Congress and I've heard it about the Senate and this president or that president. I am just so curious because I haven't met anyone personally on the street who has said, man, we shouldn't go to the moon. We shouldn't spend any more money on space exploration. I've met many people that say we should do it a bit smarter and try to work with other nations to do a better job of it. Is that something you find also?
It's about 50-50 if you look at the public polls, which is, again, about what it was in the 1960s. There is a sense, I wrote another book called Space 2.0 where I talk about this quite a bit. There are these kind of three main forces. There's NASA as the world's premier space agency still. There's the private sector in the United States, which includes both traditional aerospace contractors and these new entrepreneurs who are showing, even by NASA internal studies, that they can do things for anywhere from half to one-tenth of what it costs NASA to do the old-fashioned way. And then there's the international sector, which is both government agencies and some private enterprises. If you can take these three forces and find the magic spot where they overlap, now you've really got something. You know, if we get the best of American industry with the best of NASA, with the best of international agencies and corporations working together to tackle the moon or Mars or some other target. Now we're moving faster, we're working smarter, we're working cheaper, and we're really getting affordable access to Earth orbit. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to work out that way for a while. There's a little too much nationalism at stake in both the U.S. and China particularly, yes. And India also. And they're competing again. But U.S. seems to love competition, so maybe that's the way to go.
Yeah, hopefully that'll work out. Now, before I get lost, because that opens up so many questions also. But now, Rod, the Apollo 11 was not the first Apollo rocket to travel into space. How many missions were there before the moon landing itself, and what was their success?
So Apollo 7 was the first mission, and that went up in 1968. That was to test the Apollo spacecraft in Earth orbit. Very successful. Apollo 8, of course, that was the big gamble. We were afraid the Russians were going to beat us in just a loop around the moon, not an orbit, but just a quick loop and come home. That would have stolen America's thunder. So in a very daring decision, they sent the Apollo capsule and service module, the propulsion unit, out to orbit the moon on Christmas of 1968. Had that single engine failed to break them out of lunar orbit, they'd still be there. So that was an incredibly daring decision, very dangerous flight, but successful beyond all measure. Apollo 9 tested the lunar module and the command module together in Earth orbit, worked very well. Apollo 10 was sort of a dry run to simulate a landing on the lunar surface. They went out to the moon with the command module and the lunar module, did fly down to within a few miles of the lunar surface, and then ejected the bottom stage and flew back up the command module. How frustrating must that have been for the guys in the lunar module to get that close? Then finally, Apollo 11 in July of 1969 makes the landing, one that was fraught with drama and near misses, but was wildly successful in the final conclusion.
All right. Now, a great many people came together to make this event of a lifetime possible. How many people worked on this project, and what were some of the technical challenges that they faced in the 60s?
The numbers we always hear quoted are about 400,000 if you count all the contractors, and that's, of course, the main contractors like Boeing and Lockheed and North American Aviation and so forth. And then the subcontractors, there were thousands and thousands of smaller subcontractors all working together on government bids to make this happen. The challenges were all over the place. I mean, when this started in 1961, we didn't even really know what questions to ask. They hadn't figured out what the spacecraft was going to look like or how it was going to accomplish its mission. So first they had to decide, are we landing one big rocket on the moon and bringing it back, or are we landing pieces of a rocket like we did, just the lunar module, coming back with that and then leaving it behind in lunar orbit? How are we going to do this? So they had to make those decisions, and then they had to engineer those machines. The lunar module in particular was a huge challenge because it had to be, because of the limitations of the equipment and where it sat in the lineup in terms of the order of the mission, it had to be very, very light. And it got to the point where Grumman the company that built it was actually paying a bounty of thousands of dollars per gram to anybody in the company, whether you're an engineer, a secretary, or a janitor, it doesn't matter. If you come up with some way to save some weight, we'll give you thousands of dollars. And they spent a fortune doing it.
Wow.
And they got it down to proper weight just in the nick of time in late 1968 to make that 1969 landing date. And it's an incredible story that I don't write enough about in the book, but I do give it the best coverage I can.
Yeah, what a great time to be a janitor at Grumman at that time.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, Rob, will you take just a moment to share with our audience where they can find out more information about your book, First on the Moon? And also, if you know where they can go online to find out more information about space exploration today.
The book is available through Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com and any retail bookstore or online outlet. And I have more information on my website at pylebooks.com. That's P-Y-L-E books.com. In terms of general space information, I'm a big fan of space.com. I used to write for them quite a bit, and I really enjoy them. They're a wonderful resource. And then also, I edit a magazine for a group called the National Space Society, and they have a website at space.nss.org. They are a group of human spaceflight enthusiasts. Their primary goal is the settlement of space with human beings. But there's a wealth of information on that website. And if you join, you get copies of my magazine every quarter, something that I think is very much worth reading.
All right. Sounds great. Okay, so now let's get back to the gentlemen who were going to space for us. How were the men chosen for this mission, and who were they?
So Deke Slayton ran the astronaut office. He was a Mercury astronaut that didn't get to fly on Mercury. He flew later in Apollo, and he was put in charge of the astronaut office. And he always swore that crew selections were somewhat random, that he could put anybody in any position and they'd work like cogs in this perfect machine. But of course, nothing's ever that simple.
No.
There was some favoritism. There were preferences. For Apollo 11 in particular, it was kind of a crew of odd comrades, or as Mike Collins put it in one of his excellent books, we were amiable strangers. You have Neil Armstrong, the very quiet, studious, scientifically curious man, great sense of humor, but somewhat introverted. You got Buzz Aldrin, a little less jocular, wasn't really the kind of guy that could hang out at a party full of test pilots, but brilliant guy who got a PhD from MIT in orbital dynamics and saved the day on a couple of occasions in space missions. And then finally, Mike Collins, who was the command module pilot who stayed in orbit while the other two went down the lunar surface, who was very much a kind of a gentleman in the classic mode. He was the raconteur. He was the appreciator of fine wines and fine food and would really be the one to launch into philosophical discourse at a party. So wow. These three unusual candidates came together and flew as a team and were brilliant as a team. And if you listen to the radio signal coming down from the lunar module as Armstrong and Aldrin are landing, they're working together like a machine, even though they had their differences as individuals.
All right, now here we get to July 20th, 1969. The moon landing became a reality for this country. What were the challenges in space that these brave men faced before and after the moon landing?
So space really doesn't like people very much. It makes it very hard for us to stay there, and everything has to be done with the utmost care and caution and redundancy to make sure that people make it home. It's a lot easier to send machines out there. So once the Apollo 11 astronauts left Earth orbit, they had to make the transit to the moon. That went swimmingly. Then when it was time to land, they had to transfer to the lunar module, two of them, Armstrong and Aldrin, close the hatch, undock from the command module, and head down the lunar surface. When they undocked, there was a little residual air in that docking tunnel. It was just enough of a pop to push them about 3 miles downrange.
Wow.
Something NASA hadn't accounted for. So now they're coming down, they're landing. Armstrong realizes he's coming a little longer than he wanted, so he's trying to figure out where a good place to land is, and the computer starts acting up, and they're getting these computer error codes, 1202 and 1201, which means that it stopped displaying their range and distance to the surface and their velocity, and without a computer, you can't land on the moon. It's not something you can joystick without that data. So they're getting a little nervous when the computer's locked up on these four digits on the screen. Finally, on mission control, they look up the computer code and say, okay, that's a temporary thing. It'll reset itself. Don't worry. It did. So now they're down close to the surface. But on the ground, all they're seeing is Armstrong hovering laterally because he's trying desperately to find a place to land because he's sort of running off the edge of the map of their landing zone. And there's a huge crater in between him and the next piece of flat territory. And then on that flat territory, there's still a bunch of boulders. You can't land on anything bigger than a beach ball or a basketball, or the lunar module is going to have problems taking off. So he was very short on fuel at this point. The fuel was lower than it had been on any simulation, and they had done thousands of them. Mission Control was getting very nervous, but finally, with about 30 or 40 seconds to spare before they had to abort, Armstrong sets down the lunar module, and they are good to go.
You know, this is an amazing story. And like you, I was around when this happened, but there's a lot of information that many of us just didn't have. So, Rod, I want to thank you because your book, First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience, has so much wonderful information that many of us did not know and pictures that we've never seen. So thank you again for coming out and speaking with us today and sharing this great look back and anticipation for the future.
My great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you are welcome. I look forward to hearing more from you, and I'm going to check out your site.
Okay.
All right.
Get in touch anytime.
All right. You have a great day.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with author Rod Pyle. You can find First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience in bookstores and a number of online retailers as well. There's also much more at pylebooks.com. That's pylebooks.com. I'm David Fleming. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. As KVC Arts continues, we'll have Jonathan Linden in conversation with author John Cholian. He was on the show in the past, talking about his then-recent book, The Great American Sports Page, A Century of Classic Columns. Beyond the sports writing, though, he had quite a few years and quite a few adventures writing for a variety of shows in Hollywood. He was in the earliest days of L.A. Law and Miami Vice, working with Dick Wolf, who would go on to create Law & Order and its many spin-offs. He also wrote for Wise Guy, Midnight Caller, and more. That's up in just about 3 minutes.
Today we have John Cholian. We just had him not too long ago for an episode about his book, The Great American Sports Page. But there's something we didn't get to talk about during our last episode, and that was how John has a big history of writing for a bunch of Hollywood TV shows. And I wanted to bring you back on the show and talk about that, John.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
Yeah, no worries. So you have quite the repertoire of shows that you got to work on and write for. I think the biggest one that I might say that stuck out to me was you didn't necessarily write for the show, but you created the character of Xena, Princess Warrior, correct?
Warrior Princess, yeah.
Warrior Princess, yeah.
Show business works in many strange and mysterious ways, and this was further proof of that. I was running the writing staff on a show called Hercules, which was syndicated and had a good following, and we wanted to do an episode about a warrior princess who showed up to challenge Hercules as the world's greatest warrior or whatever. We took extreme liberties with the myth. And so one Sunday afternoon, I went to my office at Universal. I think I was probably the only guy on the lot other than the security people, and came up with the name Xena. And then we had to cast Xena. I wrote the script, and that passed muster. But we had to cast Xena. And that turned out to be a problem. We originally cast an actress named Vanessa Angel, who was really lovely and delicate and frail. Didn't really fit the image we had of a warrior princess. And on top of that, she was not physical at all. So we had to send her to horseback riding lessons and martial arts lessons. And she was going to get bounced around a little bit in the making of this show. That was just the nature of the beast. So we were going to start shooting the 3 Xena episodes of Hercules right after the new year in 1995. Boy, this seems like ancient history. I guess for a lot of people it is. and so she called, Vanessa Angel called us from London, where she was with her family for Christmas, and said that she was deathly ill, because she couldn't travel, and we'd have to go find another Xena. Well, the deadest week in Hollywood is the week between Christmas and New Year's. There is nobody in town. And the guys I worked for, Sam Raimi and Rob Cappert, who had made their names doing horror movies like Army of Darkness and Evil Dead and Darkman, they were geniuses at it. They called up every B-movie actress I could think of. We were talking to blonde Xenas, brunette Xenas, African-American Xenas, Asian Xenas. If a Martian had been in the mix, I wouldn't have been surprised. Ultimately, one of our young producers on the show, a fellow named David Icke, bright young man who's gone on to have a wonderful career, said, what about Lucy Lawless? And Lucy had acted in a couple episodes of Hercules in the early going of the show. We said, well, yeah, okay, what about Lucy Lawless? And we called her in New Zealand, and she said she was available. And we said, well, you want to play Xena? And she said, hey, that would be cool. And so we had our Xena, but we didn't know what she would be like. I mean, we knew she was a striking-looking woman, and we knew she was tall, but we still had no idea. And when I got the first day's dailies, the stuff we had shot in New Zealand and got shipped to Universal City, I popped it in my VCR, which is how long ago this was, and watched, and I watched about 2 minutes of it, watched her riding a horse and spotting a band of pilgrims being attacked by outlaws, because she rides down and jumps off her horse and starts swinging her sword, and she's just killing these guys, and she's kicking them and disemboweling them and doing everything else. And I thought, my God, she's Xena. She was perfect. There was nobody else on the face of the earth who could have been a better Xena than Lucy Lawless. It was a miracle.
Yeah, and so she actually knew how to do all this stuff even before you guys cast her.
Yeah, I mean, I think New Zealanders grow up differently than little British girls. They're more vigorous and outdoorsy, and certainly Lucy was all of that. And actually, when we called her to offer the part, she was mining for gold in Australia with her future ex-husband.
Wow, she was doing a lot. So you didn't end up staying with the show? You just helped create it?
There's Stephen Bochco, who was kind enough to bring me into the business in, 1986. Said there should be a special credit called Created and Deserted By. And what I did is I stayed with Hercules to run that show. And then Rob and Sam brought in a very, very good, very talented TV writer-producer named R.J. Stewart. And R.J. Stewart brought the show into being. He really did a great job and deserves all the credit for making the show run for as long as it did, which was something like 5 or 6 years.
So you were actually working on Hercules while you were creating this new show?
Yes, and I was also writing a pilot for the Fox Network at the same time.
Wow.
That was better than anything I'd ever written for television, but it never got made.
Oh, wow.
So that's also the way television works. Every writer out here has a story along those lines.
That's John Chulian in conversation with Jonathan Linden. He was on the show in the past talking about his then-recent book, The Great American Sports Page, A Century of Classic Columns. We're hearing about another side of Chulian, away from the sports writing and into the world of script writing for Hollywood. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org.
I want to talk a little bit about how you got into the film writing, the TV show writing business, because like we talked about in your last interview, you were actually a sports writer before that. How did you end up in Hollywood?
Well, once again, it's another miracle. For a long time, I had a lot of good luck out here. I had my best years as a sports writer, writing a column for the Chicago Sun-Times. First the Chicago Daily News and then the Chicago Sun-Times. And then I went to the Philadelphia Daily News. And when I got to the Philadelphia Daily News, I soon discovered that I was repeating a lot of the things I had done in Chicago. And the Philadelphia Daily News had a wonderful sports section, one of the absolute best in the country. You know, it was a great place to work. But on my 40th birthday, I decided I wanted to try something else. So I started fishing around and calling people who knew people who worked in Hollywood. And through a succession of people, I found out that, what I was told, the greatest piece of information was that everybody gets into the business being show business, a different way. And so I said, well, what if I wrote a letter to Stephen Blackstone, was the co-creator of Hill Street Blues and L.A. Law, and went on to create a whole bunch of other series. But he was really a seminal figure in TV drama. He changed the look of it. The writing was sophisticated and dealt with tougher issues than ordinary cop shows ever did. He was really a genius. And so I wrote him a letter and said, "Dear Mr. Bochco, I'd sure like to do what you do for a living. How can I make this happen?" And I tucked in a profile of Mike Royko, the great Chicago newspaper columnist that I had done for GQ, and a copy of a book, a collection of my boxing stories called Writers, Fighters, and Other Sweet Scientists. And then I went off to cover Wimbledon in 1985. And when I got back from Wimbledon, there was a letter from Bochco saying he promised to read my book, and he wanted to warn me, however, that a lot of journalists think they can write for TV, and a lot of journalists can't. But if I was still interested, to let him know, and he would send me some Hill Street scripts to study. So I wrote back and said, you know, nobody in newspapers or magazines had ever gotten back to me so quickly, which was the truth, and please send the Hill Street scripts. So then I went off on vacation for a couple of weeks. And when I came back, there was a big fat envelope with the Hill Street scripts in it and with a letter from Bochco that is framed and hangs on the wall here in my office and says something like this: "Dear John, I've read about half your book so far. You're a wonderful writer. I'll be surprised and disappointed if you can't make a living writing for the screen. If I ever get this show about lawyers off the ground, I'll have you write a script for money.
Wow.
P.S. You type great. I didn't spot a single do-over in your letter." That was the day of the typewriters, my friend.
Yeah, wow.
So almost a year to the day later, there I was at 20th Century Fox on the lot in the old writer's building. We were working on the first story I would write for television. So it was Stephen Bochco, his co-creator, Terry Louise Fisher, who'd been a lawyer, and me. And I was lost. I was completely out of my element, Jonathan. But, you know, I was panic-stricken. And finally I thought, "What have you done all your life, dummy?" When people were talking, you took notes. Start taking notes. And so I did. I took notes all day, furiously. And at the end of the day, Stephen said, "Well, you're going to take those notes, and you're going to turn them into a beat sheet." It's basically a scene-by-scene outline of what the episode is going to be. So you know what the gist of the scene is. It may be three or four or five or six sentences about each scene. And so I went off and I worked on that for a couple of days, and I brought it back to Stephen at the Fox lot. And first thing he did that day was wrap an arm around my shoulder, and he said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Well, I think so." And he said, "Well, you look like a horse in a burning barn the other day."
Oh my gosh.
I guess my fear was palpable. But anyway, we worked on the beat sheet a little bit, and then he was taking a flyer on three writers at this time, untested writers. He believed in bringing new blood into the business. So there was me, the sports writer. There was a young lawyer from Boston named David Kelly, who turned out to be one of the great writers in television of all time. Created Picket Fences, Ally McBeal, Boston Legal, and, you know, a score of other shows. And there was also a woman whose name I cannot remember, and if I could, I wouldn't reveal it. But she had just turned in her script, and it was not good. And Stephen was visibly deflated by it because it meant extra work that he really didn't have time to do. Launching a TV series is not easy. And he had many, many other things to take care of, but now he had to rewrite the script. And I saw his pain, and I said, "You know, I don't want to waste your time, and I don't want to waste mine." I said, "What if I write five or six scenes off this episode that we've outlined, and if you like them, I'll proceed, and if you don't, we'll part as friends." And he said, "Fine." So I went off to a friend of mine's apartment. I was staying a different place every night. I was using Hyatt points to stay in hotels. And
wow.
If a friend was traveling somewhere, then I went and stayed at his apartment or house. So I had a friend of mine, Mike Downey, a great sports columnist for the LA Times, was traveling. And so he let me stay in his place at the marina. So I worked on the scenes. I mean, I slaved over them. And on a Friday afternoon, I brought them back to Stephen at the Fox lot, gave them to him, and he said he promised to read them and get back to me as soon as possible. So the next day is Saturday, and I'm out wandering around the city and finally come back to the Downey's apartment at about 2 in the afternoon, 3 in the afternoon. And the message light is blinking. So I play the message, and it's Stephen, and he's saying, "I don't know what you're doing hanging around with sports writers, kid. You're in show business."
Wow.
And I was in, just like that.
Wow.
I finished work on the script. My dad died in the middle of all that. Tom Bosco was totally cool with my handling it. And he was could not have been nicer or more gracious or more supportive.
And what was the name of that show that you were writing for again?
L.A. Law.
It was, yeah.
I never even mentioned it.
No,
that.
Yeah.
LA
I thought it was L.A. Law. Yeah, I wasn't sure if you had said it.
Yeah, this wasn't just any other show. This was another one of those shows that helped change television for the better.
For L.A. Law, was that like near the beginning of the show, or was that...
I wrote episode number 9, if I recall.
Wow, correctly. First season. And were you with L.A. Law for all of its seasons?
No, I did this strip on a freelance basis. And I know that after I came out of my first meeting, Stephen's assistant, the fabulous Marilyn Feeblecorn, looked at me and said, "John, where would you like us to send your check?" And I said, "I think I'm going to like this business." But to get back to your question, the staff member who I worked most closely with on my script was the executive story editor, Jacob Epstein. And Jacob was lobbying hard for Bosco to put me on staff. But Bosco was much too smart for that because he knew I didn't know anything about the law and I didn't know anything about TV writing, really. But he sent me over to his mentor at Universal, a guy named Bill Sackheim. And before Bill and I could get something going, Miami Vice called me. I'd met a story editor on Miami Vice at Jacob Epstein's birthday party. Turned out they were doing a two-parter on boxing. And they knew I knew something about boxing, so I went over there. And the guy running the writing staff was Dick Wolf, who went on to create the Law & Order franchise and then all these ridiculous shows set in Chicago. And so Dick and I did 2 scripts there, and the next thing I knew, I was on staff at Miami Vice. So in June of 1986, I was a sports columnist in Philadelphia. By November or December of 1986, less than 6 months later, I was a TV writer on staff at Miami Vice with writing credits on 2 of the hottest shows in television.
Wow. So within that period, you did L.A. Law and Miami Vice.
I did.
Wow.
Yes.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Many past KVC Arts programs are at iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Back now to Jonathan Linden in conversation with John Shulian, author of The Great American Sports Page, A Century of Classic Columns, though he's talking tonight about the variety of TV shows he worked for, or in some cases helped to create or contribute to the earliest days of development.
How was that transition going from, you know, Philadelphia to being a sports writer and then all of a sudden being in the big, I guess you could say, big world of Hollywood? Was that a rough transition for you at first, especially since it happened in such a short amount of time?
No, I don't think I had time to even think about what I was doing. I just knew that I had work to do and that I had a lot to learn. And I just was so busy, I didn't have time. And then I would tell people, you know, people would say, "Well, how'd you get in the business?" And I would tell them, and they would just look at me in wonderment. They couldn't believe it because, you know, most people struggle and scratch and scrape to get into the business. They come from different fields. I've worked with guys who were lawyers, lots of lawyers in TV writing, but also electrical engineers and golf professionals and health club instructors.
Wow.
And TV news people and, you know, they come from every possible direction.
Was there other shows that you also got to work on? I actually have your whole list of shows that you worked on. You also worked on JAG at one point. Were there...
That was later in my career, yeah.
What were some of the other shows that stuck out to you that you got to work on?
From Miami Vice, I went to a show called, it was a dramedy called The Slap Maxwell Story, and it was about, of all things, a sports columnist. The star was Dabney Coleman, who I think basically played himself. Cantankerous and fascinating to watch. He really was. Then I went to Wise Guy, which was a very, very cool crime show about an undercover cop played by an actor named Ken Wall, who should have been a far bigger star than he was. And then Jonathan Banks was also one of our regulars, and you know him from Breaking Bad. He plays Mike Herman Trout on Breaking Bad.
Wow.
And then after that, then I went to Midnight Caller and had two wonderful years on Midnight Caller. We filmed it up in San Francisco. It was about a San Francisco cop who'd accidentally killed his partner in the line of duty and wound up with a drinking problem, and he becomes an all-night talk show host, and hence Midnight Caller. And he goes out and solves people's problems. But that was really a very... I just had a ball doing that show. It was fun to write, and we had wonderful actors and wonderful guest stars. From there, I went to Reasonable Doubts, which starred Mark Harmon and Marlee Matlin, who the Oscar-winning deaf actress from Children of the Lesser God. I think I entered my he can't keep a job phase after that.
Oh, man. So there was a period of time where you were struggling to find gigs?
I had everything going. I was trying to write a Mike Tyson movie for HBO, and we were trying to do a TV thing where we brought The Untouchables back to the air. And both of them blew up in different ways. And suddenly my phone stopped ringing. So for a year, you know, I went back and did magazine work. My mother died, so I had to take care of that and take care of her at the end of her life. So the timing, if I was going to hit a slump, it was actually a good time to be doing it. And I wrote, you know, I was probably writing a pilot or two every year at the same time.
And when you're writing a pilot, are you getting paid in any way for those kind of things? Okay.
Yeah. You know, you establish a price, and then you hope to get a little bit more with each pilot you do.
Would you say that you wrote a lot of pilots that weren't able to make it on air?
I would say I wrote nothing but pilots that weren't able to make it on air.
Besides Xena, was there any other show that you had created that was able to get on air, or...
No, no. The one show that always brings me heartache when I think about it was The Ring, the boxing series I told you about. And years later, when I was actually very near the end of my time in Hollywood, we had a meeting at the Sci-Fi Network. We were doing Tremors for the Sci-Fi Network. And Tremors had been a very cool little science fiction movie with Fred Ward and Kevin Bacon and Reba McEntire. It was a very cool little movie, and we thought we could make a cool little TV series. And actually, we did a pretty good job of that. But there was all kinds of infighting, and ultimately it just went nowhere. But anyway, we were having a meeting about Tremors at the Sci-Fi Network, and one of the executives there came up to me after the meeting and said, you know, I was just talking to the guy who was my boss at the Fox Network back when you did The Ring, and he said that The Ring was the best pilot they never did. So I didn't know whether to laugh or cry, but it was a good piece of work. You know, I feel much stronger about the quality of my prose. I think I was a far better writer of prose than I ever was of television speak. But that show, and then a screenplay I wrote that was based on a magazine piece by the legendary W.C. Hinds, also about a boxer, that was the other good script I wrote. So I wrote two really good scripts that I'm proud of in 20 years, and took my retirement, and now I'm living happily ever after.
That's John Chulian in conversation with Jonathan Linden. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Now, beyond writing for TV, there's a side to John Chulian which involves musicians as well. That's just ahead.
What was the kind of final point for you where you were kind of like, I think I'm done with script writing?
Oh, I think when we did Tremors.
Was it just kind of the politics that made you want to step away?
No, I mean, I tended not to get too involved in politics. You know, I just thought that there were better things for me to do with my time. So I went off and I taught for a semester at my alma mater at the University of Utah. And I wrote a novel that got published a few years ago. And I did magazine work for Sports Illustrated and GQ. And I wrote pieces about country music, of all things, for the New York Times. You know, I got back to just doing things. You know, I had made enough money. I certainly am not scandalously wealthy or anything like that. I wish I were. But, you know, I made enough money that I could be comfortable living the kind of life that I wanted to live.
Yeah.
And I think that makes me very fortunate. You know, I made a lot of good friends working in Hollywood. People are my friends to this day. And it was a fascinating experience. But, you know, newspapers and magazines were fascinating, too.
So now you're kind of doing some books now and then, right? Like the one we just interviewed you for last time.
Right.
Do you have any other books coming up in the future that are in the works?
Well, I started work on another novel. It's called Lucky Buck. Well, I hope I live long enough to finish it. But that's the story that's been kicking around inside my head for years and years. And finally, I think I've got a tenuous grasp on it. I hope I can make something of it. I like the characters. I like the conversations I hear in my head when I'm washing the dishes at night.
Is there any other stories or insights that you have about your experience in working in Hollywood?
I always felt that coming from a journalism background helped me in Hollywood in terms of being able to write on demand. If somebody said, we need a scene in an hour, I could write that scene. You're sort of Pavlovian, you know? Somebody tells you to bark and you bark. So that helps a great deal.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, and over the course of my newspaper career, you know, I covered cops and robbers. I covered murder trials. I covered all kinds of tragedies, fires, you know, row house fires in Baltimore, and Bloods, where volunteer firemen got washed to their doom. So you see all kinds of things, and I've met lots of great characters in my life.
Yeah.
You know, not just people like Muhammad Ali, but boxing promoters. The guy who ran in Baltimore who ran a boxing gym over a strip joint. So you develop an ear for the way people speak.
You had the opportunity to talk to a lot of music stars as well.
Yeah.
Who were some of those people that you got to talk to?
Well, I got lucky because at the Baltimore Evening Sun, where I started my first job as a reporter, nobody was writing about rock and roll. It was the early 1970s, and they had nobody writing about rock and roll. It was like, well, what century are you guys in? So I went out, and I did a piece on the Grateful Dead, and I did another one on Alice Cooper. Alice Cooper, who, while I was interviewing him, asked if he could see my pen for a minute. I was taking notes, and I gave him my pen, and he used it to stir his drink.
Wow.
I thought he was going to sign somebody's autograph. You know, so anyway, then I convinced the people at the paper, at the Evening Sun, that they should have a once-a-week rock and roll column and that I should write it. And so I did that for a couple of years until the managing editor decided that nobody cared about rock and roll anymore, which is the way things go sometimes.
Yeah.
But anyway, I had a wonderful time. You know, I wrote about Bonnie Raitt, and I wrote about Bo Diddley. Wrote about the Reverend Al Green, one of the great R&B singers of all time. Went to Nashville for a week and had, quite frankly, the best week I ever had in newspapers. The people in Nashville were just great. I played pinballs with Waylon Jennings and went to a recording session with Tom T. Hall, who was absolutely a wonderful guy. Had an audience with Dolly Parton, who was just tiny. She's a tiny woman with a big, big talent. I mean, she's just great. She was so funny and so smart, so real. And I was on stage at the Grand Ole Opry while it was being broadcast, because in those days it wasn't a TV show yet. So you had somebody up at the microphone singing, and off just a few steps away you'd have Roy Acuff balancing a fiddle bow on his nose.
Wow. So if you had any advice to make to someone who was wanting to go into the writing business, whether that be for television or being a journalist, what would that recommendation be to them?
Just write and listen and watch. I mean, pick things, you know. Journalists should do more than listen to people. He should watch them, to pay attention for small quirks and details, not only about the person you're talking to, but details about the setting. To be able to paint a picture of a scene, be able to establish character with something that people do, as well as with what they say. You know, one thing I tell writers is listen to music, because music, you know, kind of partial to country music, because all country songs tell a story. You know, if you listen to the wonderful songwriter named Guy Clark, if you listen to a song he did called Let Him Roll, you're a whole man's life story in the course of those four verses or whatever it is. You know, and that counts for something. And sentences, when you write them in the world of prose, have a rhythm to them. You know, and if you watch good movies and good TV shows, you'll see in a sense a different sort of intelligence at work there. You know, someone, Robert Towne, is a great screenwriter. He rewrote vast portions of Bonnie and Clyde, and then he wrote Chinatown, Champ, and The Last Detail. It was very close together, too. And someone once told me of Towne's dialogue. He said, you know, you could hear Robert Towne's characters breathing. And I thought, that's about the coolest thing I ever heard anybody say about a writer.
Thank you so much again, John, for being willing to do a second interview with us. It was a pleasure.
Well, Jonathan, I'm glad to do it. Good luck to you, all right?
Oh, thank you so much.
That was John Chulian in conversation with Jonathan Linden. You can find his book, The Great American Sports Page, A Century of Classic Columns, at many bookstores and online retailers. With that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to John Chulian and Jonathan Linden, and on earlier, Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Rod Pyle, author of First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Sharina Wad, and Benjamin Perper. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year, quick and easy, at kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.